The McIlvaney Weekly Commentary, covering monetary, economic, and geopolitical news events.
It is a surprise. We're going to see things that were unexpected. And those are the kind of things where we say we're watching the red lights flashing. These are the sort of things we're watching, because if you get too many of these sort of things, you're going to definitely have it hit the market and investors are going to begin to panic. And then we could see the end of the bull market come about.
Now here are Kevin Orrick and David McIlvaney.
Welcome to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick, along with David McIlvaney. David, friends of yours, friends of the family for many years, are the Aiden sisters. And of course, for decades, they've written an excellent technical analysis of the market. One of the questions that a lot of our clients ask is, okay, so the stock market shouldn't be rising, but it is. Gold should be rising, but it isn't. So is it better, if you can't beat them, to just join them?
Well, and I think that's a good question. You know, it's not the question that I was asking the first time that I met them. I was probably 10 or 12 years old. We were at their office in San Jose, Costa Rica. And I just thought they were lovely ladies who had very bright ideas and making keen insights and observations, most of which I did not understand at that age. And so the question that you raise, yeah, I think is a relevant one. The question of how far the markets can be pushed through manipulation and money printing is also very critical, because it is a game of confidence, and it is a game, if we've learned anything from history, those games based on confidence, they work until they die. It's very difficult, if not impossible, to predict that moment of catastrophe when everything changes.
Well, and there's different time scales. For those who are retired right now and living off of their principal because there is no interest, timing is critical to them, and it can create almost sweat of blood, you know, as far as watching the markets do what you don't expect because of manipulation. But for the person who's got the longer term time scale, who doesn't have to spend up their principal, who can wait, it still seems probably the best policy is to do the right thing and wait.
Well, that would certainly be my opinion. And I think as we touch base with others, there's echoes of that. If you'll recall our interaction with Andrew Smithers just 6-8 months ago, he would prefer to be 100% in cash. He doesn't care that there are gains to be missed out upon in the stock market. And it's almost as if he looks at that pile of sand, and it continues to grow in size, and it's growing in size, and it's the biggest pile of sand he's ever seen. But his concern is really that we're getting to a point where it only takes one grain for the entire pile to collapse. And he's not sure which grain it is. I don't think he even cares which grain it is. He just looks at the total base and realizes that it's insufficient to hold everything above it. And on that basis, would rather not speculate with money that took decades to create in order to just earn a few percent more. So, you know, there's an interesting component as I read the Aidens, and we read very broadly each day, each week, each month for our business and for the commentary. Things that I glean, I'll probably part company on the long equity position, generally speaking. You know, you can afford to be long equities if you have a sufficient amount of cash and precious metals on the sidelines. I mean, that's the beauty of what we call our perspective triangle. You can be one-third wrong and be allocated as much as one-third to equities as long as you're two-thirds right. That is, having some diversification into cash and precious metals that serve as an offset to volatility and other forms of loss that can be incurred on the equity side. So, very interesting insights from the Aidens today. We hope to explore those in the area of bonds, the dollar,
equities, gold. I know they're still very strongly bullish on gold in the long run, but there seems to be a strange duality, Dave, and I think you can address this today with the Aidens, in that you do have people who acknowledge that manipulation is working, and there are people who are willing to play that game with a portion of their assets, even though they know it won't last. And then there's the other side of the market, which is, yeah, we do know reality, and we're just not going to touch it. So I would love it if you would bring that up with them.
Certainly, and it's really the contrast between long-term thinking and short-term thinking, long-term investing and short-term investing. And I remember a conversation had on a plane, as I'm often on a plane. This was a gentleman, an executive, who had sold his technology to Google. for data mining. He was originally University of Texas physicist, now a bicyclist extraordinaire, competes internationally and has supercomputers in half a dozen different locations around the world, and he trades the market. And I asked him, you know, what his perspective was, long-term, short-term, and he cussed at me. He said, I'm not a something-something investor. And he went on to say, my portfolio turns over completely at least 100 times in a day. So, I mean, I guess what I'm saying is you can define perspective on the basis of being very short term, as in nanosecond trading, or very long term, thinking in terms of the next 50 to 100 years,
right,
or somewhere in between. And I think that's very critical as you're coming to terms with who you are as an investor and the decisions that you're making. What kinds of time frames do you have in mind? And if you make decisions, as most investors do, with a stated long-term objective, and then come under pressure over a 6-month period, 12-month period, 3-year period, what have you, and then begin to think like a short-term investor, what you've basically undone, misengineered, basically deconstructed, is the original rationale for what you own and why you own it.
You forgot who you were. You know, Shakespeare said in Hamlet, you know, to thine own self be true. Now, that sounds selfish, but actually, it's a great concept. You need to know who you are and stick with it.
Well, self-awareness is something that's critical, not only for healthy living, family dynamics, but also in the context of investing. And so maybe that's an aside, but the long-term versus short-term thinking, there is always going to be, when you're looking at charts, both that bird's eye view, looking at a long-term chart, and focused in on the last 6 months view, and you're really having two conversations which sound very similar at the same time. So as not to confuse that, we will be discussing, you know, cyclical, secular, short-term, versus long-term markets. And the insights hopefully are helpful from the Aiden sisters today. Well, so many things are in flux. Just here in the next few days to weeks, we've got the end of quantitative easing 3, something that has been a great boon to the investment markets of late. And quite interestingly, we have a gap. We have a gap between global GDP estimates and global stock markets. And that gap has widened considerably over the last 18 months. We have economists at groups like the IMF and the World Bank. Perhaps they're getting overly cautious, but meanwhile, the equity markets have continued to exhibit euphoria, you could say. Maybe you could just talk about this difference between declining expectations in terms of the global economy and yet really strong market activity as it shows up in the charts and as we see in the pricing of the equities markets in particular.
Okay, well, this is Pam. I think we both want to make a comment on this. But for one, we think the bond market has been telling us all along what's going on. And we don't think it's that much of a coincidence that exactly when they announced tapering at the start of the year is exactly when the bull market in bonds started. And it looks like it has a ways to go still on the upside, at least for, say, the next 6 months to a year and maybe longer. And really, we think this is going to be an important moment, hearing that they may postpone the end of the QE program has caused the markets to move a lot already lately. So we think this is going to be a big influence on the markets, especially looking over the rest of this year and possibly going out into the next year, exactly where the trends are going to fall depending on their program and depending on the world program too, because everyone else is starting up a QE equivalent type of program and the world is sluggish. So we think that the bond market is kind of telling us which way everything's headed, and it's starting to outperform on a big picture basis, the gold market and the stock market. Not to say anything else is going to be bad, it's just saying there is this change.
Well, this is Marianne, and I just wanted to add that you're right. The slow global growth has been very much contrary to the stronger global stock market, but just recently, in the last couple months or so, the global stock markets have really turned weakish, and they're more reflecting these deflationary pressures that are intensifying, therefore the bonds going up. But our feeling is that we really think QE4 is probably right around the corner, especially if these stock markets stay weak or keep fluctuating wildly like they have here in the last week or so. It's just too risky, I think, for all of the world central bankers, those that are in charge. I don't think they're going to just stand by and idly watch the stock markets keep heading down.
something is apparently different this time in the sense that we have had a bull market in equities for a number of years now, off of the lows since 2009, impressive growth figures in the U.S. equity market, to a lesser degree in the global equity markets, but we are now coming to the end of this QE3 period, and stocks have declined at the end of each period of bond buying over the last 5 years. Isn't it fair to say that the nature of this rise is quite different than the past bull markets, say of the 1920s, of the post-war period, of the 1980s and 90s? There's something different by character.
Yes, clearly we have thought that this has been a subsidized bull market. And if we didn't have the QE program at all, who's to know where the stock market would be today? And since 2009. So yes, it is a different bull market. We feel it definitely is more of a manipulated bull market, but nevertheless, it is a bull market. And that's where we have taken the idea of it's better just to go with the trends that are in force rather than try and not be in them just because they shouldn't be in a bull market. But yes, that clearly this is different this time.
Yes, and this is Marianne. I just wanted to add too that, as you mentioned, since 2009, it's been pretty much QE driven, and every time they taper QE or take it away, the stock market has come down. And that's just another reason why we just think it would be very surprising to see the Fed just stand by and take away QE3 and not do anything more. It's kind of hard to imagine. So we think if for no other reason than the very weakish economy, low inflation, and a falling stock market, those would be reasons enough for a QE4 to come along very soon.
So changing tax just slightly, we have bonds, which you've described as being in a bull market and perhaps another 6 to 12 months of that. That is with rates in decline and higher prices of bonds. And if that outperformance continues, what does it mean to you when bonds have above equity market returns?
This is Marianne again, and the fact that bonds are so strong. The bond market is a very interesting market. A lot of people think it's boring, but it's far from boring. It's really a very good leading indicator. And bond investors, per se, are known to be more sophisticated and more forward-looking than, say, stock investors or precious metals investors. So what the bond market says is very important to everybody and to the economies of the world. And so basically what bonds are saying very loud and clear is deflation rules right now. And it's in the driver's seat. And until bonds turn down, bond prices, that is, and interest rates start to rise again, that'll probably continue to be the case, as you mentioned, for at least the next year or so.
Just a question added to that, Marianne and Pamela. It seems that not only is the bull market in equities subsidized, but we are in this low rate environment also in part because of the manipulative purchases of assets by central banks. So the bond market may very well be sending a deflation signal. But on the other hand, we have record amounts of market intervention and price setting by the Bank of Japan, the European Central Bank, the Fed. It's virtually a free-for-all who can buy what the fastest by your world central banks. So how do you factor that into bond market behavior when you have this tremendous amount of artificial buying?
Well, again, this is one other factor that contributes to the bull market in bonds because, yes, they're buying a tremendous amount of bonds. And again, whether that would be the case if the bond market is as strong as it is without it is probably, you know, very unlikely. But the fact remains, I wouldn't say it's the only thing driving the bull market, but it's certainly a contributing factor.
It's just curious that the basis for market activity and pricing at present has less to do with economic factors, less to do with company fundamentals, and more to do with central bank liquidity than anything else. Does that in any way concern you or have you taking cautious measures within an allocation?
Clearly, it concerns us. The base has changed. It is a central bank intervention-led market and will be, it looks like, for some time to come. But that doesn't mean there are trends there for investors to take advantage of, but it means you have to invest and always be cautious. But being cautious and walking the wall of worry is not a new idea either. But yes, we do have different rules right now, And that is what concerns us. And that's where ultimately gold will always be in the background as an excellent investment and to buy during weakness. Like, we think it's very impressive to see that gold didn't want to break its December low just recently. It had all the reason to break it. And it's not to say it's over. It could be broken. And if it does clearly break those December lows, then the bear market will get a little bit deeper before we see the end of the line, like looking over the valley. But we think, like with the gold market, it might stay quiet for several more months or more than several months. Say within a year from now, we'll start seeing it react to all that's been going on. So gold, we still like it. We think it's been the best one in the gold market for looking at the precious metals in general. Of course, aside from palladium, but looking at silver, and silver being more of a reflection of the reality of the global growth, so therefore staying more sluggish. But it'll in time move with gold when the time comes. So we don't really think that time is now. But it's good to see they're not falling more for the moment. That shows strength right there.
Just a reminder, you're listening to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. Please remember to send us your questions that you'd like to have answered over the next few weeks, as we'll have a show specifically devoted to answering the questions of our listeners. Send those questions to McIlvaney@McIlvaney.com. That's spelled McIlvaney at McIlvaney.com.
Looking through your most recent report and the portfolio recommendations that you make, there are outsized triple-digit gains in a number of your recommendations. They are metals-related. For anything triple-digit, you've got to be in the metals. For anything less than that, there's a variety of options in terms of gains over the last several years, even the last several months. I just thought it was interesting that between equities, bonds, and precious metals, there is a standout in terms of performance in the precious metals sectors from your point of recommendation. Now, I'm wondering if you might shed some light on that by discussing the difference between a cyclical bull or bear market and a secular bull or bear market.
Well, it's funny. We were just talking about that. This is Pam again. It depends on what trend are you looking at. If you want to call it a trend or a tendency, is like if you look at just since 2009, yes, that would be the cyclical. Yes, gold is down versus the stock market, say. But I mean, the stock market since 2009 has been rip-roaring, and even with the correction lately, it hasn't changed that, whereas gold has. But if you look at gold going back to the beginning of the bull market at 2001, 2002, that trend is clearly still underway. And that's the difference between what are you looking at? Are you a longer-term investor? Are you a 2 to 3 year investor? Are you a yearly investor? So it really depends on what you are and how much you're willing to hold and ride through things. And so that's why you'll see a higher percentage in our breakdown, because you'll see those positions we bought a long time ago versus the other ones. So that's basically what it is. It depends on how much you're willing to ride through any market.
Well, you have the Dow, you have the S&P, and they hit new highs in mid-September, going back to the stock market for just a moment. And there has at the same time been a divergence between the small caps, Russell 2000, even between the utilities and the S&P 400, all diverging, moving down in trend for the last 3 to 6 months. With this change in dynamics, if you will, sort of the internals of the market, less new highs, things of this nature, what can we learn from the Dow and the S&P moving higher with a variety of other markets signaling a decline? Are we moving into a change in dynamic with the Dow and the S&P now potentially moving lower following the S&P 400, the utilities, the small caps, or is that something of a head fake? Are we in a longer-term secular bull market in equities, or is this just a short-term cyclical trend?
This is Marianne, and it's interesting because it's true. The small caps started down months ago. That was the first time you kind of saw that divergence, and then, you know, it comes down to, are they leading, or is the Dow leading, for example, or the Dow Transportation? The markets that were S&P 500, they were all hitting highs. And so we were watching that for a while. Here in the last recent couple weeks, the stronger markets followed the weaker ones down. But now we're seeing them all start moving up again, and they are still technically bullish. So they never did break down enough to where it was worrisome as looking at a longer-term trend. So for now, we're still saying they're looking okay. There's obviously cautious signals and red lights flashing to keep an eye on them, but so far, so good.
The practice of the last several years, not every company is subject to this critique, but certainly with IBM's earnings out here recently, they were not able to prop up their quarterly results as they have for nearly 2 years by a massive expansion in corporate debt and the simultaneous funding of share buybacks. And I'm wondering if this sort of pervasive practice is concerning to you, because certainly if you're looking at the performance of IBM shares, up until this week's disappointment, didn't show up in the charts.
No, it didn't. And it is a surprise. These things are going to happen. I mean, we're going to see things flying at you from left field that were unexpected. And those are the kind of things where we say we're watching the red lights flashing, caution signals. These are the sort of things we're watching, because if you get too many of these sort of things, you're going to definitely have it hit the market and investors are going to begin to panic. And then we could see the end of the bull market come about. But if that happens, we still believe that it's going to be very much a Fed reaction, and it'll probably happen quite quickly to get it back on track. And if that doesn't happen, we'd be very surprised. But as you mentioned, anything's possible in these manipulated markets. You just don't know what's going to happen.
Yeah, I'd like to add to that, this is Pam, is that NASDAQ has one of the best rises of the last several years, being a tech-related index. So some bad news can get it back into more, if you want to call it, normality within the indices. So that could be part of it. Another thing, too, on a technical basis, we could be seeing like more of a downward correction than we've seen for the last 3 years. Even if we get a 10% correction on an index basis, that will be shocking for many people. And we haven't even had that yet. It's getting closer. But we could see a little more downside, yes, on the stock market. But that doesn't necessarily change the major trend yet.
Well, and as you say, QE4 or QE to eternity still may be in line. And it's interesting, it's becoming apparent that the total stock of debt, whether that's private, corporate, governmental, the whole caboodle of debt, I don't think that's a technical term, caboodle, but that is becoming unsustainably high. We have quantitative easing, which has failed, and equity investors are kind of the last to get the memo, because, again, we assume that asset pricing moving higher, intended to create a wealth effect, intended to thus boost the economy, and it hasn't exactly happened that way. So in spite of the trillions of dollars in credit created over the last 5 years, there is still a real threat of deflation, which you've already highlighted. In your opinion, will the Fed and other central banks be forced to redouble their efforts, go back to QE4, or at some point are the markets going to figure out that these liquidity stopgap measures are not actually delivering what they're supposed to deliver? Yes, they may boost asset prices, but it's not trickling down into the real economy.
Exactly. That's exactly the point. When could that possibly happen? The next, if there is another QE4 or to eternity, as you say, during that period, and it could be as well as next year, say looking ahead, there is going to be a point where things can't continue staying the way they are. But for the moment, we think it can. I mean, it does look that way, because it seems like things always take longer than you'd imagine.
This is Marianne. I just wanted to add, look at Japan. Japan's been doing this for ages, and it's still plugging along. And so the U.S. and now the European zone, is they're following in Japan's footsteps. So you could say, well, how long can this continue until people finally get the memo, so to speak, as you mentioned? And they could keep going for a long time.
Yes. And also, if we're in, like you mentioned, a low interest rate environment, it looks like interest rates have already started tending down, and they'll continue, it looks to us like they'll continue down to probably test those 2008 lows over the next, say, 6 months to a year even. And that also is a good thing for the stock market. Low interest rates are good for the stock market. And it's good for gold, too. And in the meantime, it's also, of course, good for bonds. So it could go on for a while longer. But yes, you're very right in saying that at some point, things are going to click and change. We just don't know that when is the big question.
Yes, and just to add to that, when is the big question on everyone's mind? And there'll be signs along the way. I mean, we think we'll be able to identify warning signs that the end is near, so to speak.
you know, there's upside potential in many markets. It seems like the one place where there's only downside potential is for the saver and the household who have diligently set aside capital rather than spending it all as they earned it. They've set it aside to help cushion a retirement income draw. And there is this notion of the magic 5%. If you save $1 million or $100,000 or somewhere in between, earning 5% on your money, that was kind of the implicit, unstated expectation of the saver. And not only do we have far less than 5% on offer, whether it's in a bank CD or in U.S. Treasury bills or in U.S. municipal bonds, but we also have just general incomes in decline. Coming off of 1999, 2000, the real median income was roughly $57,000. Today, it's about $52,000. We've been in decline in terms of income. And again, this goes back to our first question. This gap between global GDP estimates and the real world economy, which is driven by real incomes, and the stock market's asset prices, which are reflecting central bank activity, there ultimately is this rubber hitting the road and the reality factor of individuals coming to terms with not having enough money to make ends meet. Now, in the past, if you recall the 1919 to 1924 period, Rudolf Havenstein just said, well, if there's not enough money, we'll just print it. And I'm not suggesting that the Fed, either under Ben Bernanke or Janet Yellen, is somehow experiencing a Havenstein moment, but they are creating a tremendous amount of credit out of nothing. And I wonder if there isn't some speculation on your part about the transition between a decidedly deflationary trend and something that could represent that Havenstein moment, a hyperinflation.
Yes, that could be exactly where it all turns. As just like Janet Yellen said this past week, she mentioned inequality in the U.S. today has never been so large since the 19th century. Like, there's very rich and very poor, and the middle class is disappearing. So this is a very big concern for everyone, and this is exactly what probably is going to be the turning point. And whenever that, when we were asking about, definitely this will have a big influence on that.
Just to go back to what you said about the savers, that's, to me, one of the saddest things in this whole picture is that people who have worked their whole lives and saved as they were told to do or thought was the right thing to do and the prudent thing to do, they are collecting zero interest. And so it's very sad. And so what you have here as a result is you have people that are retiring that either can't make ends meet, and the ones who did have some money saved up have to pretty much just plan on using that money to keep them going till they die without the benefit of the magic 5%, as you said, or they're taking a lot of risk going into markets to try to increase their nest egg. So it's a real sad situation.
As we wrap up, I think some attention, we need to shed some light on the dollar. The dollar has broken out above the 85 level. It has yet to break out above the 89 level. And certainly it's constructive in terms of the dollar trend in the short run. We've lost a tremendous amount of ground over the last 10 to 15 years. And you did mention something about gold earlier, that it's held up quite well, all things considered. And I think of the major moves higher in the dollar, sort of go back to the 90s, when it went to very high levels off of, say, 93, 94, 95. It had a good 6, 7, 8 year massive uptrend. And that period of growth in the dollar certainly was not positive for gold. In this period of increase in the dollar, it hasn't been altogether negative, however. And I wonder if you could sort of shed some light on that relationship. You have market experience, of course, going back decades. So, you know, we also have that time frame of the late 1970s where the dollar stabilized and began to move up. And gold was moving up as well, where there was not necessarily a relationship where the dollar was moving down and thus gold up, or vice versa. So let's talk about dollar strength. Let's talk about where we're at, where we might go, and on what basis.
Okay, this is Pam. It's so interesting, gold and the dollar, the relationship. I mean, this is one of our favorite things to keep an eye on all the time. It's interesting because, yes, it's true. They'll sometimes move together, but most of the time they don't. But I guess they can, and they can for months on end at times. But what's most noticeable is since we've had a noticeable dollar rise, it's been holding above its 2011 lows. this is starting to look a little bit like when we saw the lows in 1980 and the lows in 1995, which are really the two major lows of the last 40 years when you look at the dollar big picture. And if you look at in each case in those days, the dollar had a rise of about 5 years, and that was during a downward correction in the gold price. So now we have it, since 2011, we've had the dollar rising. It's been 3 years now. So I say, like, if you see the next year or two, it's just throwing out another number, that we could see the dollar strengthen. Gold remains lifeless, maybe, lackluster. That could happen if that's going to have a repeat sort of performance, because that's the only time in the last 4 years that the dollar has been strong, were those two time periods, and now it's stabilizing. It's really not strong. But yes, if it goes above 89, then clearly on the dollar index, we could see the 90-91 level reached. And probably much more than that is unlikely, but that's kind of like the upside we're looking at. And if gold holds like it has been above the lows of last year, which is the recent lows that we've had now, then yes, gold is showing a lot of underlying strength. But that alone is telling us that gold is trying to become the final currency of the world, and it could eventually become that, because no country wants a strong currency. And the dollar, just this recent strength since June, has already shown the government doesn't like that at all. It doesn't help them. It hurts them. They don't want it. They don't want a falling dollar, but they don't want a strong dollar. Nor does anyone else. They don't want their currency too strong. So this is what the ultimate will be. Sometime in the future, we're going to see that. So the fact that gold is not falling so much is telling us a lot.
Again, you're right. It seems like a strong dollar is at odds with current monetary policy, trying to stimulate growth in the economy. You're creating a new form of headwinds in terms of our export and manufactured goods sectors. So listen, thank you, ladies, for joining us again, giving us kind of an overview, a bird's eye view of the markets, past, present, future. Always enjoy visiting with you, and our listeners always give us great feedback on the insights that you bring to our conversation. So very much look forward to seeing you soon.
Oh, thank you. Yes, thank you very much.
You've been listening to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick, along with David McIlvaney and our guests today, Pamela and Marianne Aiden. You can find us at McIlvaney.com. That's McIlvaney.com. Or give us a call at 800-525-9556.
This has been the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. The views expressed should not be considered to be a solicitation or a recommendation for your investment portfolio. You should consult a professional financial advisor to assess your suitability for risk and investment. Join us again next week for a new edition of the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary.